Hi, this is Paul, and it's a great pleasure to have John Vervaeke on the channel again. John, thanks again for being generous with your time. You've been doing tons of interviews lately, and I really enjoy your content. And it's sort of like Easter eggs when someone sends me another one of your videos on some small podcast somewhere, and I get to enjoy it.
Thanks, Paul. I had such a good time. It was such great pleasure talking to you last time. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Yeah, I've been very busy. There's been lots of people who've been wanting to talk to me, and some of these conversations have been some of the best I've had in my life, and some of them have had a profound effect on me. So this has been generally very good for me overall as a person. it's getting me sort of more comfortable. And my partner, she was sort of saying, John, try to relax and enjoy it more.
Well, I'll have to say that I've been a pastor of a small church. And when I say small, I mean most Sundays there are 50 or so people gathered here. Mm-hmm. And then to have started a YouTube channel and to have lots and lots of conversation partners. Now that I've been in this about a year and a half, going on 2 years, on one hand, it's fun, but it does require adjustments and also limitations. You have to put boundaries on some of these things because the internet is a very big place.
Yeah. You can get drawn in. Although I do like the corner that you and I and Jonathan and Savella are, right, and some of the people in Rebel Wisdom, where we're carving out this really interesting, really interesting place. And I think that's very valuable. I really like that a lot.
I completely agree. You should have seen the look. So Rebel Wisdom very early on came and visited me here at Living Stones.
Yeah.
And when these two guys from the UK were setting up their cameras, and the people at my church are like, what is going on? they still don't quite, most of my congregation is I wouldn't call them elderly, but they're in their 70s and 80s. And so they're not on the internet. And so YouTube, this stuff, it's been interesting. So, I've been, you put out your Awakening from the Meaning Crisis episode every week that I look forward to. And I've been following along with that. As we talked about in our last conversation, I very much enjoyed those other two conversations you did with Christopher.
Yeah, Chris is fantastic.
And so he and I are connecting now, and we're going to do some conversations. And I agree with you 100%. This little, it's not just the topics that we're getting into, but I very much appreciate the culture of these conversations.
Yes, exactly. I was talking when I was mentioning this before. We started recording. I had this excellent discussion with Guy Sensok, the inventor of circling, and in there I mentioned how when I'm talking to somebody like yourself, and I said, here's the thing. I know that Paul and I disagree about some stuff, but I trust Paul way more than a lot of people who I share propositions with, because I understand that he's coming, he's putting himself at risk. There's vulnerability in this, and I respond in kind, and that engenders much more trust in me than just simply sharing, propositions. And so I think that's part of what I'm saying. In what I'm seeing in this community, there's like, we're going to really make sure that we can talk about stuff, even that we disagree about in a way that really respects this trust we're building, really respects mutual respect. And so, I agree with that. I think that's definitely the manner of this community, I think, is as important as the matter of this community.
Absolutely. And it's been interesting for me. And I knew this would come given my years of experience within the Christian church and the Christian community. I often get more heat from fellow Christians. And it's that tribal dynamic. And, the thing about tribes is that you need them, but they have to have their place. Yeah. And so figuring out how to navigate that in conversations, I did a conversation with ironically, probably the riskiest conversation I have is not with non-Christians, but it's with a guy who was raised in a non-Trinitarian, what they call a biblical Unitarian church. Because when you're talking to heretics, the dynamics are so hot.
Right, I can imagine.
But that
was a good thing for you to have done, though. It's a good thing for you to have done.
Well, having given that disclaimer, we're about to sort of do something that we said we weren't. But before we do this, I did want to give my own disclaimer about some of my own views about Christian apologetics and about the kind of debating that we see often on YouTube.
Yeah.
Often it's, Jordan Peterson calls them celebrity atheists. So there are celebrity atheists and then there are celebrity apologists.
Yeah.
And they go at each other with, you know, with in a certain style and a certain format, but also I think, and your course on Awakening from the Meaning Crisis has been so helpful for me in terms of giving me language to understand, you know, participatory knowing and, and all of this stuff. And
I'm,
so
I'm glad to hear that.
And so I, you know, this actually, there's a picture of my daughter's cat, which is living with us now, which woke me up at 2:30 in the morning. And then I was thinking about this conversation and I sort of pieced this whole argument together. And it was kind of a pulling together of a bunch of the stuff I've been working on. And so I can see that. Yeah. And so I thought I'd like to just run through it with you. And as you said, I mean, I trust you. And
right.
So I, you know, a good friend offers critique, because that sharpens me. The Bible actually has a verse that talks about iron sharpening iron.
Sure.
And
critique means not only criticizing, it also means pointing out what's helpful, what's useful, what's insightful. And, you know, a good conversation also means that you're really setting yourself to learn from the other person. I'm glad that you're sticking with the course. I just wanted to mention that. The videos, the last few videos have been some of the hardest. They're very formal, very sort of nut and bolt scientific. What I can say to you and other viewers is it's going to turn back towards the spiritual phenomenological topics very shortly. But so just hang in there. It's coming around.
Actually, a lot of these most recent ones have been my favorites.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Because the relevance realization stuff is really hard for people. I've been really careful to respond to some of my viewers are saying, wow, that was really hard, or that was over my head. And I'm sort of, you know, keep going. When you see what its implications and what follows from it, then you'll be able to understand why I'm spending so much time on it.
Well, and I, you know, for me too, the relevance realization and the connection with Darwin,
yeah,
that was mind-blowing and fascinating. And maybe I need to digest a lot of this stuff. It takes me a while to digest stuff. People don't understand. I'm on YouTube. I don't have a PhD. I'm not an academic. I'm not a theologian. I'm a pastor. And what that means is I'm sort of a jack of all trades. And so I'm always trying to assemble things in larger comprehensive things, and to also try to use, because part of my job is that I'm always having to talk to people that have a huge span in terms of backgrounds, cognitive ability, all of these measures, cultures. So, I mean, that's sort of what pastors do. People don't always quite understand what pastors do, but that's what I am. It's what I do.
It's a challenging job.
Yeah. So, well, teachers have the same thing. You have a little bit of selection process in terms of university, but you have a variety of cultures and,
especially for me, because I teach in cognitive science, which is interdisciplinary. So I have people from many different academic backgrounds coming together, and I have to try and present material in a way that bridges between all of those different groups. So I have some sense of what you're talking about. I don't think it's as difficult as what you face, but I have something analogous to that. Yeah. Anyways, we should get started on your thing.
Yeah, let's dive in. And in all fairness, I'm going to, what I'm calling this, present an argument, which arguments are just arguments for the reality. I'm using that, not the existence of God, the reality of God with respect to the treatment of persons. And we're going to do another video after this where John can come back with some other more non-theistic ideas, which I'm very much looking forward to.
So. Yes, thank you. I'm looking forward to both of these conversations and how they're going to resonate with each other.
So this is basically my introductory slide. And those of you who watch my channel regularly, this is sort of my format. I actually do my sermons in a similar format. So an argument for the reality of God based on the right treatment of persons. Mm-hmm. And this is within some work towards an understanding of this term person, an understanding of this word real, which is which is really difficult.
Nice pun.
Understanding of nature. That both deals respectfully with kind of an ancient perspective and a modern perspective.
Right, right.
And an understanding of this word God. Now, if there's a fudgier word than, boy, I say things and I think I'm going to get in so much trouble saying this, but it's the truth. The word God is so, yeah. So difficult.
Yes,
and when I watch these debates on the internet, and actually when I watch it play out in the Christian church or the conversations with people between believers and unbelievers, or Christians and non-Christians, or theists and atheists, mm-hmm. I just think we're using this word in ways that we're just treating it far too lightly than we ought.
I agree. And I think the way you're formulating this is a good way to start. Not treating it as a standalone term, but seeing as it bound up with these other three contentious terms. So, and I think one thing I agree with right off the bat is that they should be treated as a network together. And they're all problematic, but they're not independently problematic. They're problematic in ways that intersect and influence each other. So I agree right away with that should be how we're formulating the problem. I disagree, and I think you are saying it too, with people who simply, you know, okay, we're going to have a debate on the existence of God, and then they just start running with sort of intuitive or commonsensical or, you know, sort of folk psychological notions of these terms. I find all of that deeply, deeply problematic. So I like the way you set up the arena we're going to play in. I think I want to stick to that, you know, trying to keep these four things talking to each other in a deep way. I think it's very important.
Cool. And probably because so John and I are figuring this conversation out as we go along too. So maybe
very much.
Present the slide and then John will give some critique and we'll sort of walk our way through that way.
Yeah. And I want to do it that way, as I was saying to Paul earlier, precisely because I don't want to treat this as an abstract argument that we're just going to look at its premises and its conclusion in some sort of purely logical manner. I want to set it back into very much like a Platonic practice into a dialogue, and right, and so that we can talk to each other step by step as it's going along. So I'm trying to model how I think we should be doing this. I take it that's what you're doing too, Paul.
As am I. So I'm going to move my camera a little bit because I'll be working from the middle. And with thanks to people that I have learned from that have helped me put this together. It's really work over the last year and a half or so. Pascal a little bit, C.S. Lewis, Jordan Peterson, John Verbeke, Jonathan Peugeot, all five of these individuals have contributed greatly to this. Now we got to see if this works. Okay, because it works a little different. All right, here we go. Okay, so little bit from Pascal, and those of you who saw a recent video know that I picked up a little bit of Pascal from an introduction, and this actually was prompted by John's mention of Pascal, and I've listened to those a couple of times. Even though John has a very long project, there's so much to cover, he can often only just touch on things, which to me gives little teasers for me to dig in and research more.
So Pascal is going to be in the series I'm working on that's going to follow the Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, the After Socrates. So I want to unpack Pascal quite a bit more. So that's going to be an opportunity for me to do so. I think Pascal is important for a contemporary and early responder to the Cartesian framework by somebody who was as important. In some ways, I mean, sorry, that's wrong. He was quite important, not as important as Descartes. What I want to say, he's as gifted mathematically as Descartes. That's clearly the case.
Yes, yes. So one of the little tidbits I picked up, and when I heard this, it was like, it's just like something clicked in my head, where Pascal had this idea that we have these two modes, I'm going to call them two modes of mind. Sure. And one is the spirit of geometry, which is sort of this, you know, rational way of approaching the world, and a spirit of finesse, which is a more exploratory, participatory yep. way of exploring the world. And these are two modes of regard and two modes of approach.
Yep. And also two modes of assuming an identity. Mm. This is also part of the existential. So many people view Pascal as an early example, or at least a proto-existentialist, because I would say that these are not just modes of mind. I think these are existential modes. These are different ways of being in the world. And that's something that is important to Pascal's whole argument in the Pensée, because it's a way of, you know, talking about not just a way, because Pascal's all about how you commit yourself to a particular way of being ultimately. And so I just want to make that link because I think that's important.
Oh, that's super helpful for me, because that is very much how I see it rolling out.
Yeah, very much.
In my argument as I go. And I noted, and John corrected me in the comment section, I'm dyslexic, so I always have issues with writing.
Well, I'm dysgraphic, and I'll often write on the whiteboard, I'll misspell something and not realize it's misspelled. And all I get from it is this weird signal, something's wrong. That's so annoying. But go ahead.
So, just for the argument's sake, and again, I am a novice at all of this. And so, but when I listen to these conversations about both hemispheres of the mind, there's, you know, it's perhaps that half of the brain is sort of committed to, let's say, the spirit of geometry, of mapped territory, and the right brain to the spirit of finesse and unmapped territory. There seems these, mm-hmm. I mean, these two poles seem to be points of convergence. They come up regularly.
Yeah, so I would comment on that. One thing you should know is David Fuller at Rebel Wisdom is trying to put together a dialogue between me and McGilchrist.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So one way I would try and deepen that, again, this is critique, not just criticism, is I tend to think of, so I do a bit of work on the two hemispheres. There's a couple things you need to know. The left and right are sort of helpful ways of talking. You have to understand that it's not necessarily don't think of it as essentially left and essentially right. There are people, for example, who have hemispherectomies early on in life, and you'll find both of these functions in the remaining hemisphere. So that's an important, we're talking more functionally here. It happens that it's often anatomically located, but it's not dependent on that. And that's important because I think it's ultimately a functional difference. And this is what I would say, this is what I argue elsewhere. I think the left hemisphere deals with familiar situations that are well-defined problems for us, whereas I think the right hemisphere deals with much more unfamiliar situations that tend to be more ill-defined for us. And as soon as you think about it that way, you can think about, right, the kinds of problems, you face these two broad types of problems throughout all of your existence, the well-defined problems and ill-defined problems. And that's why you're going to see two fundamentally different strategies. What we should also remember, though, is that the two hemispheres are mostly always working in an opponent processing fashion, not an adversarial, don't mishear me, right? Right? They work in a sort of corrective checks and balance back and forth between each other. So I just wanted to sort of deepen the cognitive science, get a little bit more about, I think, how we can understand what the hemispheres are doing.
I think that's very helpful. And your treatment in Awakening from the Meaning Crisis on problems, I found that section so, so helpful. Again, for me, that course has just been just lights coming on for me. I'm 56 years old. I've lived a little bit of life. And sometimes now there are words for things that I've always sort of known. It's just, we waste college on the young, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's thank you for saying that. I mean, part of what, and this is why, again, I want to do a dialogue and not just, you know, a theoretical criticism, because which we're in dialogue, we can together make new vocabulary, together craft a better theoretical grammar. That's why it's important.
Okay. Those of you who've been following my channel for a long time know that I've C.S. Lewis's book Miracles has been a favorite of mine for years. It sounds weird, but as a sort of spiritual discipline, as a pastor living in a very secular society, I found I really wanted to read this book a couple times a year. And just because Lewis would sort of, he had kind of a shamanistic effect on me, sort of jarring me out of some easy assumptions I would make that actually now with this vocabulary of a meaning crisis, that I think I would find myself getting frustrated, depressed, and I would read this book and it would sort of shake me up a little bit. I don't know, John, if you've ever read this book.
No, I mean, I've read some Lewis. I've of course read, like everybody else, all the Narnia Chronicles. And my favorite passage in there is, I don't know what they teach children these days. It's all in Plato. But so I know that. I've read Till We Have Faces. A long time ago, I read the Screwtape Letters. But I haven't, I'm really interested in reading a book that you've recommended, The Discarded Image. I want to get that book. That looks very good. I haven't read Miracles, so I'm saying right now I'm ignorant of the book. I'm trusting you to present the argument on his behalf.
Yeah, I won't present his whole argument, but this Discarded Image is the last book he wrote, and I had never read it. I inherited a bunch of Lewis books from my father and my grandfather. And that book wasn't in it, and so then I picked it up at one point. And I just read it, and the timing of it was absolutely perfect in terms of this conversation and figuring out the meaning crisis. Because I think actually Lewis and Barfield and Tolkien were very much in the wake of World War I dealing with the same thing.
Yeah, very much, very much. I think World War I is one of those watershed events in which the meaning crisis comes to the fore. World War II, to some extent, too. Especially because of the atrocities, right? Because you can see the existentialists responding to that. Yep. But go ahead, please.
Okay, so he makes this argument early in the book that naturalism, and I'm going to tweak his argument a little bit. Lewis is a fervent Platonist. I mean, he
pretty much
really is.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
But he makes this argument that if naturalism, and this is the kind of naturalism that he grew up in the Church of England in Belfast, and then as a young teenager, he gave up his faith with the death of his mother and became an atheist, was educated by the great Nock, who was a tutor of his, who was very much a rationalist, you know, I would say a far more vigorous rationalist than even many of the celebrity atheists that are around today. Very sharp, very consistent, very locked down. Well, Lewis then, you know, later on he had a conversion and he's thinking about naturalism. He says, in many ways, the vision of the universe of naturalism is what the universe is that the whole show, meaning everything we know about, everything we can know about, is in a sense one gigantic chain of cause and effect. Now, he will not hold anyone to actually be able to demonstrate this because no one could, but that's in a sense the posture of naturalism towards the world. That in a sense is its presupposition. And then that, now I'm taking Lewis from Miracles and getting into a little bit of Discarded Image.
Right.
And very much into your course. And I really appreciate the animations channel that takes some of your stuff and makes it into some little videos.
Zeke's work. Those videos need to have more viewers.
Yes, they do. They really do.
Really, really great work. Yeah.
And I found it, I mean, for those who are struggling with your long
fair
class, that's great notes to kind
totally,
of
totally. Help
people see it visually.
Well, I thank every one of the videos Zeke did. I thanked him for it. I thought it was perspicacious. I thought it was excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think in those videos, it shows quite nicely. And I think in your treatment of philosophy, when we get to Copernicus and Galileo, human beings become alone in the universe.
Very much. I agree with that.
And that's very foundational to the meaning crisis. Whereas our presupposition is that everything else is one gigantic chain of cause and effect. Here we alone, in a sense, have autonomy and agency and will in this world. And so, and then we have this terrifying suspicion, maybe we're just deluded to thinking we are the exception. And it, then suddenly we're in, you know, I liken it to sort of being a victim of Lou Gehrig's disease, where you're trapped within your body. You know, you can't help it, but you're also deluded in your mind in terms of thinking that you have agency. And and then Lewis makes the final point that that's, in a sense, the setup of naturalism, at least the naturalism he was dealing with at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes.
And he said, but we don't act like that's true. And he uses a variety of people who, you know, who stand up, and he says, these people who are naturalists, at the moment of crisis, they stand up and they speak like, you know, they speak like people, even though their worldview says they're just part of the whole show running through this script.
No, if we could pause here, because I have a couple of comments on this. So first of all, I think that the way you've linked what Lewis is saying to the problem I'm posing in the series, I think that's right. There's a sense in which we have this worldview in which we don't belong, insofar as we are meaning makers that act on purpose and have, you know, have sort of qualitative experience of that meaning making and acting on purpose. I agree with all of that. What I would respond, I guess, is a bit of a challenge, is the adequacy of Lewis's representation of naturalism. And since nature is one of the things we are going to be trying to unpack, many people, I would include myself in this, see naturalism as including a lot more entities than sort of cause and effect or just material objects. So structural functional organization, information. I mean, even with physics, in order to deal with the black hole paradox, they're really seriously considering information in the technical sense, at least, as being, you know, something that is fundamentally real. And so patterns are real, all kinds of relations are real. And many naturalists are what are called non-reductive naturalists. We don't believe that all of these entities that we consider real can be theoretically reduced to sort of, you know, quantum states or things like that. So many people, again, myself included, resist the idea that naturalism should be wedded inextricably to a reductionism. So some of the conversations I had with Jean-Pierre on this, about trying to bridge between a naturalism that sees something like a deep continuity between the levels and his panpsychism, might be a place where you could see that conversation taking place in more depth. So I just wanted to step and say, I think Lewis is right in one sense, and it's an important sense. This is not to be dismissive or a left-hand complimenter. Sorry, that's insulting to left-handed people, but that's the phrase. Right. That worldview is the pervasive worldview, and it is a worldview that I think in which we do not find a place at home. And that worldview is one that is advocated for and defended by many people explicitly on the internet. Now, perhaps where you and I are differing, although I'm not sure to what degree the difference is I think the home of the tent of naturalism is much bigger than that. And it includes a lot more variation and a lot more options. And of course, that's what I try to argue in the meaning crisis, that we, given what's happening in third generation for ECOG, so we have to, because that's what those movements are doing, expand the notion of naturalism such that it can reincorporate us back within it. So that's where I would sort of say, well, your argument, there's a sense in which I think your argument flows, but there's a sense in which you need to step aside and perhaps say, as you did it parenthetically at one point, at least the naturalism that Lewis was talking about at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think a fair thing to do is to note that there are many people who, and I think part of what their motivation is they want to respond to the fact that we don't fit in the worldview, are really trying to expand naturalism. Now, that, of course, then just shifts the question, is whether or not that project can be successful. But I thought it was important to bring that up.
Oh, I think that's helpful. Part of, I think what we struggle with is, especially when we're dealing across some tribal borders, that, well, Christians are ill-informed of the variety of positions in the non-Christian world, and often non-Christians are ill-informed of the variety of positions in the Christian world.
Totally.
We've got 24 hours a day, and a third of it we have to sleep and take care of ourselves, and it's it's just really important that we talk to one another to make sure that we are actually being fair with one another about things like this.
Yeah, so thank you. I think that's important. Please continue.
Okay. So here you are talking about Kant, and I've listened to that lecture about five times. That was one of my favorites.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to take a little bit of Lewis and a little bit of Pascal and put them together for the sake of science, because science is a very important piece of this whole conversation, obviously. And I think the practice of science, and this is where I get some of the as if that Jordan Peterson has sported all over with his business about God.
Sure.
I think in the practice of science, and I think this is a legitimate practice, we act as if the universe is is connected deeply. And there might be different ways that it's connected, but in science, in a sense, we act as if there is no God. And I think that is legitimate. And I've spoken with numbers of Christian scientists who, when I listen to them carefully about their practice and how they piece together their faith and their practice of science, that's what I hear from them. And so we, in a sense, approach it with the spirit of geometry. And I think that's real. And your lectures where you talked at, where in some of these cognitive sci, where you're, okay, we want a non-homuncular argument and we want a non-circular argument. Lectures have been hugely helpful for me, for helping me get my head around basically, okay, what are we doing when we're trying to do science?
Yeah, I think that's very important. Thank you for saying that. Science has a particularly important status, with respect to our ontology. And to pretend that's not the case, I think, I think that's pretentious. I think we just have to acknowledge that science has a special role with respect to our ontology. I am not a positivist. I do not think that science has the sole right over, sole exclusive rights and privileges over our ontology, but neither do I want to deny, because, I practice it, neither do I want to deny that it has a very significant and special role in our ontology. And so I'm critical of both of those moves.
Oh, good.
I'm critical of people who want to, who want to assert that science is the only thing that can do our ontology, because one of the things science can't do is establish the ontology of science, right? And other things like this, right? And positivism and logical positivism, I think, are one of the few philosophical positions that you can say are properly dead, right? And so I reject that. But I also reject people who think that they can do ontology without paying attention to science. I think that's a non-starter for me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, well, I was going to say, I think it's legitimate for Christians to, and so there's a lot of Christians, and someone made the comment today on Twitter, someone who's listening to our stuff, nostalgia is a medication that people apply, how did he say it? Something to the, when their worldview has a virus. And yeah. I thought, that's right. So, okay, we're going to close our eyes to science, but we're going to go fill up the tank where the oil was found by geologists who are employing the science. And Christians don't go to the doctor and say, do you practice biblical anatomy? I mean,
exactly. Right. In my recent Q&A, and you were there, by the way, I saw that. Thank you very much. I was pointing out, you've got to pay attention to cognitive science and artificial intelligence, because it is coming, and it is going to shake up your ontology and what it is to be a person way more than Darwin and way more than Copernicus ever did. And pretending it's not going to happen is not helpful. It is not helpful. We have to start thinking about this now, really deeply, right now.
Yep.
So that's why I think it's important.
And so then I guess that the main point of this slide for me is that in science, we, whether or not you're a theist or, you know, whatever you're, you in a sense bracket these and say, okay, with respect to the world, I'm going to pursue the world as if the spirit of geometry can continue to gain ground.
Right. And so, I mean, and I, one way in which I stand aside from that, and this is a tricky thing because I feel that it's fair to say I'm criticizing it from within a scientific perspective via cognitive science, but, and one of the themes of the series has been the criticism of the reduction, and notice that word, of all knowing to propositional knowing, which of course is what science generates. Science generates propositional knowing and propositional truths, and that's, those are really important. But the practice of science depends on procedural knowledge, which depends on perspectival knowing, which ultimately depends on our participatory attunement. And so you have to be very, very careful, right, to remember like what you're talking about and not to confuse properties of your theorizing with properties of what you're theorizing about.
There's a scholar that, you know, people throw me stuff all the time now, named Drew Johnson, who, he's an Old Testament scholar and he's working in some of this field, and he noted the procedural similarities between ancient people conducting a sacrifice, right, and modern scientists conducting an experiment.
And you can see that also in Bacon, right, where he talks about putting nature on the rack and torturing her to reveal her secrets. And Polanyi was very important on this, and that's why he's had such a huge influence on me too. That we have to always remember the practitioners of science and not treat science as if it fell from the sky. That's very important.
Okay. So now, for the sake of humanity, mm-hmm, and our sense of aloneness, we also act. So we act as if it's, you know, the whole show can give way continually to the spirit of geometry. We also act as if the universe is not the whole show. Mm-hmm. And we aspire to not treat people as objects. And we demand that we not be treated as objects. Sure. And we act as if there's an important category of person. And this important category is rightly approached with the spirit of finesse.
So I think that's important. We should, my cough is in no way indicative of it. I'm literally just got something caught in my throat. So first of all, the centrality of person, I picked up a book and I'm going to start reading it soon by Josiah Royce, because he tried to build an ontology in which person and personhood was central. So I think we should talk about that. So can I ask you, and this is an open question, what do you mean by we act as if it's not the whole show? Do you mean that we feel that there's meaning and normativity, like that people should be treated in a certain way, right? And that the people are working in terms of meaning, not just in terms of physical properties? Is that what you mean by we think there's more to the show?
Yes. And if let's say you are having a heated conversation with a significant other, and let's say you feel that a spouse, I've been married 31 years now, so you get to know someone pretty well after 31 years.
I would hope so.
And you feel that you sort of have the other person figured out, and now in your mind you've sort of put them on the side of the spirit of geometry. Right. Number one, people who do that, it doesn't go very well. They're usually wrong, because, and this is at least as much a function of our limitation. Even after 31 years of marriage, my wife will do things that I'll think, I didn't see that coming. And I've been married for 31 years.
This is what I meant when I said Pascal's things are, what Pascal is talking about is an existential mode. Mm-hmm. Like, what I hear you saying, so tell me if I'm wrong, what I hear you saying is we ultimately can't have an I it relationship to people. Yes. We can when, you know, we're getting on the bus and stuff like that. But, you know, we're bound to them in friendship or love, right? Or as in your case, your lucky case, marriage has not worked out so well for me, but I'm glad it's worked well for you. We can't have just an I it relationship with them. We also have to have an I thou. Is that what you're saying? And there's something. Okay. But so part of what I think that's deeply right. I talk about this in one of the four episodes at the very end of the series, a bit when I'm talking, when I go into depth about Heidegger and also a little bit about Harman and what's called speculative realism. Because one of the things they're arguing, because you had the Kantian picture up a minute ago.
Yeah.
So if I could just talk about this a little bit, because I think even if you, you know, in the ultimate sense disagree with it, I think you'll find this valuable and useful. So what one of the things the speculative realists are talking about, and here's how they were influenced in important way. I won't go into that. But one convergent line is I think there's a similarity to the early romantics that had such a huge influence on Barfield. So what's this notion? Let's go back to the thing in itself, right? So you've got Heidegger, and I won't get into Heidegger full blown because that's huge, but I will later in the series, right? But Heidegger has this notion of, you know, at the level of participatory knowing, truth isn't the correctness of our propositions. The correctness of that proposition ultimately depends on an attunement between the agent and the arena. Yes. And the kind of attunement, I it or I thou, has a terrific effect on what we can judge to be correct. Is that all working? And you see how it fits in with what we're talking about?
Yep.
Heidegger points out that this aletheia, which is the Greek word for, lethe means to forget. So it's this kind of deep remembering, this existential remembering. Right? Heidegger points out, or he argues, and this is something that I think is really sort of phenomenologically profound, that and phenomenon means to shine. This is something that Jordan Peterson advertises a lot about, right? Right. And so, right, as the object is shining into our frame, I'm going to use a little bit of my language, right, and becoming relevant and salient to us, it is always also simultaneously withdrawing in its combinatorially explosive reality. And let me use my language a little bit more closely. So he talks about the withdrawal and the shining. And the argument is, and you can see this in some of the work I'm doing with Dan Chiappi on virtual reality, like that to have a world real isn't just that everything, right, is disclosed in this intelligible pattern of confirmation to us. That world also, as I am, right, as it's shining into my frame, it has to be simultaneously enmeshed with the sense that it is withdrawing into this moreness, this moreness from which. And so I've coined a term for trying to say what all these people are talking about. We don't have the thing in itself. We have the thing beyond itself. Everything is a thing beyond itself, right? So this is one of the key notions of at least Harman's work and others, that it's not just people. And this is not meant to diminish the moral status of people, okay? But it's like, but what Harman argues is our sense of ourselves as a person helps us to gain access to this way in which things, the thing is beyond itself. And this is how. You see, to be a person is to have a non-logical identity between what I am in my frame and what I'm going to become as I move into another frame beyond it. That's why narrative work. Like, look, you look at a picture from yourself when you're 1 year old, and you go, there I am. That's not a logical identity. You don't so many of the properties are not shared. It's a narrative identity. It's a non-logical identity. And persons are enmeshed with non-logical identity. But here's the argument. Everything is, right? This cup, right? There's a non-logical identity between how it shines into my frame of relevance and how it's always simultaneously in a mutually supporting fashion withdrawing into its combinatorial explosive, you know, richness that is beyond my capacity to fully frame it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, this is a way, at least I think, and I don't know if this is helpful to you or not, about how, right, the notion of personhood, again, not to remove its moral privilege, right, gives us a participatory way of knowing everything, mm-hmm. right, of picking up on the, you know, the intelligible, the this inexhaustible moreness that constantly is a fecund fountain of new intelligibility, but that intelligibility never drains the thing dry. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, like I said, in virtual reality, you know, if I can drain the world dry, it's not very real. It always has to be beyond me, but it also has to be, you know, frameable by me. And those two, we have these two, this non-logical polar sense of realness, to use one of our other main terms, that I think is deeply at work. And I see this as some of the most exciting work that's going on right now in ontology. Now, here's what I have to say about that. I find that deeply consistent with the notion of naturalism that I'm working with. So mm-hmm. that's where you and I may pull apart. Because I'm not trying to undermine one of your premises. Right? I'm trying to say, look, I think that there's a deep connectedness, and I'm trying to argue for it, between, you know, our participatory experience of ourselves as persons within the existential mode of I-thou and our ability to make contact with the thing beyond itself that everything is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really important. But I think I can explain that naturalistically in terms of this language of what's inside the frame, right? And the right and the combinatorial explosive reality that's always outside the frame and conditioning it behind the scenes in ways that I, of course, don't know from within my frame.
Well, I to the degree that I understood what you just went through, and I think I think I did. And I think actually you helped me in my subsequent points, because that's very similar to the point I want to make with respect to this mode, this approach to the world.
Yes.
I also, and we're not going to get into it in this conversation, the thing that started me down this crazy rabbit trail to begin with, and what interested me about Jordan's work when I first came across it, I think Christianity, especially Protestantism, has in some ways continued to, and Jonathan Peugeot's word, just kind of float away from the material world into a sort of Gnosticism. And certain, I'm not going to name names, but certain branches even of Protestant and evangelical Christianity, when I look at how they talk, I think they're really rather Gnostic.
I grew up in that world. And so, yeah, at least a form of Gnosticism that is deserving of criticism. Yes. Gnosticism is a very heterogeneous thing as well. Yes. That's why I tried to pull Gnosis free from Gnosticism in the work that I've been trying to do.
But one of the deep challenges that I think pastors face right now is to understand Genesis 1 in terms of the goodness of the material world and what the material world is for. Now, for me, I've talked a lot about the fact that I think what the material world is actually for is glory, but I don't want to get too sidetracked. So, but my understanding of your articulation in this movement towards and away at the same time in terms of person, that's very much, I think that's very much consistent with the next couple of slides, which is, again, persons we regard with an agent arena relationship. They are agents. And people always argue about free will, and I say, I don't really like the term free will, because our will is far from free, but I think our agency is real.
Yes, I prefer that way of talking about it, too. I think agency is important. I think free will is, I'll get into trouble saying this for some of your viewers. I think free will is a mongrel concept. I think it's a confused concept in many important ways. Because I frankly don't know what people want when they want it. But that's another discussion. Let's agree that agency is a better way of talking about it, and let's go forward.
Absolutely. So, what we see when we see persons are these, and this is where I get some of Peugeot's stuff, we see a complex of powerful entities. And Peterson talks about this too. I, as a person, I have all of these, you know, I have all these desires. I have all of these needs. I have all of these experiences. And somehow all of this, you know, somehow all of this has to somehow cohere within me. And actually this Sunday I'm preaching on the demoniac that Jesus chases out the and it goes into the pigs and
Legion.
That's right. And Peterson and Peugeot also talk about, you know, we have all these sub personalities and
very much
the kind of person we respect. And actually, and I really loved how you treated addiction. And I had never heard that take on Buddhism before. That fascinated me. Mm-hmm. And this, but it very much has to do with agency.
Yes,
and
the loss of agency, I think, is a better way of understanding suffering rather than the pain metaphor. Yeah, I think so. As I argued, most of the most of the metaphors the Buddha uses are entrapment and fettering and enslavement metaphors. They're not metaphors of pain, right? I think I'm on solid hermeneutic ground there to make that argument.
So there's a deep connection between persons and agency, and
yes,
and we instinctively, I don't know if that's the right word, but we intuitively respond in that way to persons. And I'm going to get to, I'll say that for the next slide, but there's also, having said that in a sense, and that's this kind of aloneness in the universe that we feel ourselves to be as persons. At the same time, we also embrace the spirit of geometry at work within ourselves and each other to our betterment.
Sure, and, of course.
And as a pastor, someone will say, if you can help me understand the science behind me, why I am so attached to this thing over here, or why I'm doing these things over here that are clearly destructive to the integration of a rich, powerful agent that I wish to become, please, Pastor, help me work on this. And we, in a sense, apply the spirit of geometry in many ways to that. So these modes are not living in disconnected universes.
No, and the way you invoked Mark Lewis there, his thought, you know, we have the science of the reciprocal narrowing, but of course the addict is also experiencing that as a modal, which is what I tried to argue, as an existential modal thing as well. Yeah, that's very good, Paul. I like that. I like the fact that in our lives, right, we find these two modes deeply interpenetrating with each other. And perhaps that harkens back to the point I made about how the two hemispheres understood functionally, right, are almost always interdependent and doing opponent processing together. Yes. Yeah. So I think, I agree with that. I think that's very plausible.
Now, we are also persons looking at persons. And because we are persons looking at persons, there's a sort of circularity that complicates the spirit of geometry mode. And if you're a clinical psychologist or if you're a pastor and you're working with someone who is deeply troubled and in trouble, you always have to sort of watch yourself as you're dealing with them, because there's projection, there's bullshitting, there's status, there's all of these games that we're playing with each other.
Very much.
And this gets into something that I've commented often. Brett Weinstein talks about, well, once we realize we're programmed assassin Romans, we simply transcend that programming. And I think, oh my.
I don't quite know what, I mean, I talk a lot about transcendence in my series, and I try to do a lot of work as to how simultaneously how important that concept is. It's an axial age inheritance, but also how difficult that is to articulate. And so a lot of what I'm doing is trying to carefully articulate that. I make arguments following L.A. Paul, and then later also Agnes Collard, and also arguments from cognitive science, Jerry Fodor and others. You can't sort of infer your way through self-transcendence. It doesn't work that way. So I'm not quite sure what Weinstein means. Certainly, simply propositionally knowing it and running implications off of it is not going to give you self-transcendence. It's not a careful enough analysis of the problem that we face when we try to give a solid theoretical explanation of what's going on when people are engaged in genuine transformative experience. That's why I spend so much time and come back to it in different places again and again and again in the series, because I take the problem very seriously. So,
well, and, And you're dead on. And as a pastor, all my experience, and my experience just as a person, watching myself, and again, having, you know, living within a Christian profession where you always have this model of Christ that you hold yourself up to and just, you know, fail, you know, love your neighbor as yourself all the way up to and including your enemies. It's like, oh, you know, how I perpetually fail. And part of how, so we use this objectivity and what I've coined as sort of a monarchical vision. We try to self-transcend and see ourselves objectively, but that's always that's always an aspirational attempt. We never fully do it.
And you'll be pleased to know that I spent considerable time at the end, the last four episodes of the series, developing Agnes Collard's very important philosophical work on aspiration and aspirational rationality and what that means and how that's relevant. I argue to the whole notion of the divine double, or as I call it, the sacred second self, because you see that in Jung, you see that in Tillich, you see that, of course, in the ancient world. So all of that, I think, all of that, I would call it, all that mythos is a reflection of what we try to do in order to try and afford these kinds of genuine aspirational self-transcendence.
And so then the conclusion is, we rightly approach persons with this spirit of finesse. When I approach my wife, I do so with a little bit of fear and trembling, because, you know, great things are at stake.
Yes.
And the spirit of finesse is the appropriate mode of approaching persons because of their complexity and power. Mm. And respect for persons is a hard won practical, and I think a successful cultural adaptation.
For sure. I agree with that.
The West, our regard for one another, and say, okay, we are going to treat other people not as so often you see people treated in the ancient world, for example, or in many times and places, even here within families. We treat people with respect.
And yet part of what's going on is whether or not we can extend the category of person to animals and other creatures precisely to afford that kind of respect. One thing to say about this that I think strengthens your position. Alicia Uraro, who you've heard me mention in the series, because she's the whole person about the idea of, you know, the sets of constraints, and she talks about the fact that Jonathan will love this, that when you're trying to interact with dynamical systems. And let's take it that whatever else they are, human beings as persons are dynamical systems. They're complex, autopoietic, self-organizing things. Ecologies of environments are also complex dynamical systems. She says, and this is an important argument that needs to be taken seriously, and this goes towards how we access the correct sort of existential mode. She says, the reason we use narrative not just because it talks a certain, like, it puts out certain strings and statements. Narrative gets you, right, basically in the correct mode of processing because of the way you have flash forward, flashback, mini layers of processing, and it's all unfolding in this dynamic, self-organizing manner. And she said, if you're practicing narrative, what it does is it actually puts you into the right mode of mind, and I would argue the right mode of being, for tracking complex dynamical systems very successfully. Mm-hmm. Now, notice she doesn't say, and this is where maybe you and I would part company, she doesn't say that means that the ecology is actually running a narrative or something like that. But to use language that, and again, I'm developing in the series, the narrative is often indispensable to us for connecting to dynamical systems. Now, the thing about indispensability is, the concern I have about it is, and I'm concerned that people confuse indispensability with metaphysical necessity. Mm. Let me give you an example where those cleanly and clearly come apart. English is indispensable to me. I'm not bilingual in any measurable fashion, but I don't think it's metaphysically necessary that every cognitive agent speaks English in order to practice cognition or communicate. So while it's indispensable to me, it's not metaphysically necessary to a person, for example. Mm-hmm. And that's clearly, I think, uncontroversially the case. So I tend to think that we need to we need to not be dismissive and say, oh, it's just a symbol. This is what I think Jonathan would like that. Oh, when you talk about the forest narratively, it's just a symbol. He hates that dismissive attitude, and I agree with that totally, right? So I would say I would strengthen it as something stronger, like no, it's indispensable for us, and it's indispensable for getting us into the right way of coupling that participatory knowing, the agent arena activation, that we can actually track the forest well. I don't think it's metaphysically necessary, though, and here's where we might part company, but I'm just stating it. I don't think that licenses any conclusions that the forest is itself a narrative or the forest is behaving narratively in and of itself. So that's how I would respond to this argument.
Well, I think again, we're very much tracking, and
okay.
I'll just continue. Now, yes, now we're going to get into some stretching on some things. We regard collectives, and you talked to JP a little bit about this. I thought that was a very interesting part of the conversation. We regard collectives of people as persons of sorts, and we treat groups of people with the spirit of finesse too. Families, cities, nations, civilizations, we represent them mentally. You know, I will ask sometimes people the question, is Uncle Sam real? Now, there's no man who's got this top hat and will dress in red, white. You can find him at parades. This gets into Jonathan Peugeot's, is Santa Claus real?
Yeah.
But Uncle Sam wants you. And this is where you sort of get into Peugeot and I think biblical, the Apostle Paul, ideas of principalities and powers in terms of what they are. And your comment about metaphysics, I think, is apt here too. And we'll just leave that there. Historical processes. Jordan Peterson, when he talks about the future and sacrifice in this talk, the video is actually taken down now. I don't know why, but in this talk that he did in Easter 2018, the very interesting idea about we negotiate with the future via a sacrifice. And if you look at human history, at some sense, this seems to work. And does it work because people, you know, you can have all kinds of other questions about why this might work within a naturalistic frame, but we negotiate with the future. And so similar to the point I think you just made about this other author's work, there are real reasons for doing this.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. That's why, again, I dislike a lot of the dismissive debunking of what you call the celebrity atheists, precisely because they don't ask the right question, or they just assume they have an easy answer to it. That the reason why people do this is because they're stupid or irrational. That's often not a good explanation of a lot of why people are doing things they are doing that, you know, have this long-term survivability and viability and efficaciousness. And look, you know, we do most of our problem solving collectively.
Yeah.
And if we do not know how to relate to that collective in a way that we can comport our identity to participate in it, we're messing ourselves up very badly. Now, again, I think all of that is, you know, indispensable. This was, of course, a famous point made by Durkheim, we'll tend to regard that access to the collective as something even sacred. So I think that, and of course, Durkheim is a completely naturalistic thinker. But nevertheless, he's saying, but why? Why is it important? Why does it seem indispensable that we talk this way? So I agree with that. And I mean, like I said, in the conversation I had with JP, if you go to like a circling event or other events, here are these people coming out of, you know, very much post-Christian, normally secular thing, and yet they talk about what emerges in the collectivity with very often very religious language.
Yes. And this is where, you know, say if I were sitting down with a celebrity atheist, I would ask them, is Uncle Sam real?
Perella did the same thing. One of the people who did, you know, one of the creators of third generation 4 ECOG Psi, he said, you know, is England real?
That's right.
How are you going to answer that? Like, if you have a very simplistic ontology, you're going to give a wrong answer either way. Well, yes, but what? Oh, well, you know.
Real enough to make you pay your taxes.
Well, and go to war with Germany.
That's right.
Right? And things like that. And Harman makes a similar argument, the guy from Speculative Realism. He talks about the Dutch East Indian Company. He says, like, does this exist? Of course it exists, but it doesn't exist as a spatiotemporal object of a specific duration. It's smeared across time and smeared across space, right? And smeared across people.
That's right. You know,
there's people that come in and come out of it. And so, yeah, this is what I mean about you have to have a non-reductive ontology if you want to be able to talk about things. I think in a way that just does justice to them. And that, again, like I say, I see people really, Morton talks about this. He has a book called Hyperobjects, where he says, well, is evolution real? Well, evolution isn't, you know, in a place or taking up its particular time and space. But if you don't believe evolution is real, like, what the heck are you doing? What scientific worldview are you invoking such that you could appear in that scientific worldview? That's and right. So, yeah, I think, again, there's deep reasons for what you're saying.
So, and then we regard, in a sense, non-human living persons. We afford animal rights, limited, mm-hmm. Personality. We name animals. We have companion animals for the lonely. Animals are meaningful to us. Even plants to a degree. Back in the 70s, we talked to plants and all these sort of anti-entropic entities that they're very real to us.
Well, I think there's good evidence. It's not small, but it's not great. But the idea of biophilia, that we, and this is a non-utilitarian sense, we love these things simply because they are autopoietic entities. And we can, it's part of, and I mean this in the positive sense, it's part of the way our self-love allows us to automatically love these other living things.
Yep. So, and then we also act as if complex and powerful inorganic entities are persons in mm-hmm. some ways. We name our cars and our machines. Now, we fully know that they open up to us with the spirit of geometry when we take them to the mechanic. And suddenly, Tweety is the car, the name of a woman in my church who has a car with her car is named Tweety. Or I have a car named Ed. I have a car named Nelson. Right. And we fully know that these cars are not persons in the sense that even, certainly my wife isn't, or even my dog is to a certain degree, but, right. Nuclear reactors, Chernobyl, that becomes in a sense a living thing in a way, immaterial systems and institutions. This gets into Uncle Sam. And we approach all of these things quite rightly. And I think you made the point much better than I did a few minutes ago, sort of with the spirit of finesse. We treat them as persons, and that's the best way for us in a sense to approach them.
So here's something that you'll need to enter into dialogue with. And so I don't expect you to do it now. One of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, Dan Dennett, actually talks about this. He talks about it in his idea of we take the intentional stance towards things. So he says, like, very often, like towards our car, his example, like towards your computer, you act as if you take the intentional stance because it massively facilitates your capacity to interact with your computer. Now, I mention that, of course, because he is one of the celebrity atheists.
Yes, he is.
So that's a point. I don't know if I'm not making a specific claim myself here. I'm just pointing to you that your argument, I think, bears the responsibility of considering how Dennett talks about something very similarly and comes to some very different conclusions from the conclusions you do.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Because I don't think I'm making a big argument with this argument. Well, maybe I am. I don't know.
Well, I think you're making a good argument, and I think it's insightful. I understand what you want to do. You want to protect yourself appropriately from inappropriate criticism. But, I think you're doing something that many people would find of value. And so it would only help to strengthen it.
Okay. So then powerful, complex things in nature, and in a sense, nature itself, this is where the ancients, if you read Lewis's Discarded Image, you know, nature goes, so he goes through all this ancient literature, the classical and then the medieval period. And, you know, nature was a woman. We have Mother Nature. And we're very dismissive. In the modern realm, we became very dismissive of this approach. And I think what, in many ways, what we have is sort of a communal cultural bias against this, that I'm not sure that bias is well, it's difficult in that I very much understand the distinction. Calling nature a woman might not be a metaphysical claim, but it certainly is an appropriate claim in terms of how human beings relate to entities such as.
Yeah, and the point you're making is it's not just an appropriate claim, it's an affording claim.
Yes.
It's a way of thinking that puts you into a valuable mode of interaction.
Yes.
And of course, this is an argument, and it's often misrepresented, and sometimes because the argument isn't presented very clearly, but this is an argument made by indigenous people, right? That we didn't just talk this way. This way of where we talk about the spirits and everything, right? It put us into a particular way of relating to the world that seems much more healthy than the viewpoint that's criticizing that way of talking. And I think that's an important thing to pay attention to. Again, and you are taking care, you know, not to confuse what might be psychologically and even culturally indispensable to us with making assertions about the metaphysical existence or necessity of certain ways of talking and thinking.
And you know, even though JP is making his points about panpsychism, I and probably have a separate conversation with him, I see panpsychism as a sense of solving a bunch of problems by going all over on the other side of the line. And I'm not quite sure we have to do that. And so ready to make that jump.
You know, I agree. I mean, JP is very careful, of course. And he's also, I mean, in the one he did, the most recent one we did, you know, we've got this wonderful bridging discourse between panpsychism and the kind of naturalism that I'm sort of presenting here to you as well, and I found that really really beneficial. The there's a trilogy, and the one he did in between was really good because when he's comparing his position and mine, he talks about it in terms of the, and I like this because it's great language, because it's ultimately about a kind of cognitive commitment. He talks about different kinds of risks that the different positions have. And I think that, and I think that's very important. And so he does something, I really like it. He said, you know, there's enough continuity in there, and I have enough respect for Rebecca's position that if mine is wrong, I can default to his. Which, and he said, that's kind of a brilliant pragmatic argument. He says, so, you know, why shouldn't I take the riskier thing? Because, you know, I've got his position to fall back on. And I thought, that's very clever. That's very smart. That's quite good.
Strange application of Pascal's wager.
Yeah, it is, exactly. But a well-placed one, I thought. He takes the care to articulate, well, what risks? He says, you know, there's a greater chance that I'm wrong because I'm postulating extra entities and blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
But, right? You know, but there's benefits to it. And I acknowledge the benefits in the third discussion we had. I said, yeah, you get access, right, to an established tradition, established guides, established models. Of course, there's enormous benefit. And to pretend that's not the case is also, I think, disingenuous.
Yep. So we act as if, you know, weather and climate, neither you nor I nor anyone who's on this side, who's not believing in, say, panpsychism would say, weather and climate, these are, I would be, in a sense, a naturalist with respect to them in many ways. But at the same time, we approach them with the spirit of geometry and we'll learn more and more about the weather. Our models will get better and better. However, in a sense, we also treat them with the spirit of finesse and that we respect the weather. And we have our models. And this, a lot of this is coming from a recognition of our limitations.
Yeah, very much. And like I said, that we're dealing with very complex systems, and often we can put ourselves in an appropriate mode for coupling to them.
Yes.
In ways that I think Jonathan would be okay with me saying that are symbolic.
Yes.
Right. And I think that's important.
Yes. So now we're going to get into the definition of God that I want to get into, which we'll see if this gets me in hot water. And this comes out of, it's a clip I've played quite often in a number of my talks where Jordan is talking to Sam Harris and they have the moment towards the end of their first Vancouver conversation where the event is about to end. And, you know, Sam Harris is there to take Jordan down because Jordan is way too soft on theists and God. And so they, okay, Jordan, who is God? And Jordan reads this rather lengthy list of things, which I think a lot of people just kind of thought, what's he talking about? And at the end of it, Sam's like, that's not God. But I thought, Sam, you don't know enough history.
Or enough about all the religions.
That's right.
Right. Okay, I'm not going to go on about Sam.
Well, and what I came up with out of there is that, now I'm not saying there are two gods in Christian theism, and I'm not even making an argument that this is Christianity, this is sort of a theism I'm making an argument for, but one definition of God, especially God number one, now I split this out of an Isaiah passage. In Isaiah, when God shows up at the temple, the angels cry out, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. That's the transcendent God, the God who is different. You know, for the Hebrews, if a hole is deep, it's deep. If it's very deep, it's deep, deep. If it's the deepest possible hole, it's deep, deep, deep. That's how Hebrew language works.
Ah, so holy, holy, holy means really holy.
That's right. As holy as could be.
Right.
So God is as holy. He's as transcendent as could be. He's as other as could be. And the whole world is full of his glory.
Right.
So you've got these two sides. And for me, so what Jordan Peterson basically does is says, God is the system of all systems. He is, you know, so all of this Darwinian selection, all of these mechanics, all of this built-in stuff for Jordan and his ideas, sort of his ideas of God, God is the system of all systems. So that's God number one. And God number two is God is the person of all persons.
Mm.
Now, again, once you say the word God, there should be like a rule like that Nazi rule. Once you mention Nazi in an argument, it kind of goes over the edge. In a sense, once you say the word God, everything is always in danger of going over the edge. So again, when I talk to a lot of people, I can't believe in God. Well, they're thinking about some man up in the sky and it's like, well, God is the system of all systems. God is the person of all system of persons. God is, in a sense, this thing that we use in terms of how many different systems that we have, sort of like using dark matter to equalize the equations in the universe. You don't know what it is. It's dark. But you kind of need it to equalize the equations. And so we rightly explore God with a spirit of geometry as we do with other persons. Right. But we also rightly relate with God, the system of all systems and the person of all persons, with the spirit of finesse, as we do with all systems, because it's holy, holy, holy. So this is the craziest of all my slides, probably.
No, this is the funnest. So first of all, a clarification question. I want to make sure I'm not mismapping things. Are you saying, because I'm not sure about what I'm saying, are you saying that God one, the system of all systems, is born out of the spirit of geometry, and God two, the person of all persons, is born out of the spirit of finesse, or that we do both the spirit of geometry and the spirit of finesse to both God one and both God two? Which one of those is it?
Both.
I asked for a distinction. He's a
Well, in a sense, once I had this idea and once I said it, people kept writing me about this idea. And it's so weird because it's like, oh, why does this idea, this idea somehow hit salience in the Jordan Peterson community like no other idea I talked about. And I thought, well, that is interesting.
Yeah.
And so God number one is, in a sense, a God of natural theology that is, you know, he's built into the stuff of the world.
Because when I see system, I hear spirit of geometry. So this is, you know, triggering Hegel in me, right? So what I've got is I've got this comprehensive and all-inclusive pattern of intelligibility. And that seems to me to be the epitome of the spirit of geometry, because of Kierkegaard's you know, critique of Hegel. He made a system and then he sat down beside it because he couldn't live within it. And I see how you're using it. God number two as, I don't know what the noun here is, Paul, so forgive me. Someone, something that you live with, rather, right? That it's not just something that is an articulated pattern of intelligence. So I see God two as being born out of the spirit of finesse a la Kierkegaard, and God one being born out of the spirit of geometry a la Hegel. But that's not correct, you're saying. That's
it is.
You do the cringy move, so.
It's extremely difficult because and
I'm not trying to
pick it up.
Yeah, okay.
You know, if the you know, and you and I come at this by having a career of reading the Bible and trying to interpret it for people.
Right, of course.
There's sort of the divine passive all throughout Scripture where, you know, Jonathan, Saul's son, and his armor bearer see a group of Philistines and say, let's go attack these uncircumcised fellows. Who knows what God might do? Right. And that's sort of God number one.
Right.
But it's also sort of God number two. God can be very impersonal sometimes.
Yes. Right. Right.
And that is revealed in creation. Now there's other Christian narratives at work at play. And I just want to set all that stuff aside for now.
Sure.
But at the same time in the Hebrew, you know, so Aristotle, God is this unmoved mover and,
Right,
you know,
right.
Lewis nicely treats that in The Discarded Image.
Sure.
But this Aristotelian God can feel nothing because he's completely unmoved.
Yeah, he's kind of the grandest of narcissists. But let's play in that place a little bit. So an initial response is to invoke Plotinus in response to Aristotle and say, Aristotle, right? Aristotle doesn't go far enough, because beyond any summative thing, unmoved mover, there is the one. And the one is no kind of thing at all. It's not even a kind of principle. It's not even truth or goodness or justice. It is that which makes truth, goodness, and justice, right, or beauty, truth, goodness, and beauty possible, and their interrelations possible. It's what makes each one, it makes the truth system possible, and the goodness system possible, and the beauty system possible, and how all of those are systematically related in some meta system that we're still trying to figure out. But the one, it transcends all of those precisely because it is what you need to explain how they are systems and how they are systems together. So now that sounds simultaneously impersonal to me, because there's no thingness to this, and whatever else persons are, they seem to be things, right? And it's, of course, you know, it seems to be, you know, the holy, holy, but it seems to be the holy, holy of God too, right? Because it's the God, right? It's the God beyond all possible gods, where we understand a God as a thing. And part of what I see Christianity doing, at least I've tried to argue this, is trying to wed that Neoplatonic notion that really sort of vouchsafes the transcendent no thingness. I'm going to use the word no thingness to not insult people. The transcendent no thingness of God with our capacity to get into the depths of things here and now. There's a sense in which the moreness of things, there's an immanence aspect, and that those are ultimately, and I'll use a term that I invoked earlier, there's a non-logical identity between them. I see Christianity as trying to do that. And one of the things I appreciated, by the way, recently is Jonathan Pageau, in his discussion with you, and I think I noted this in the comments, made an excellent criticism of, you know, the Neoplatonic purely emanation view. And so one more thing, just to throw into this mix about trying to get God to God one and God two, and I've been trying to work out this idea inspired by Taoism on one side, and also by people from the Eastern Orthodox tradition, and also from the Neoplatonic tradition. John Scotus Erigena is having a huge impact on me with his doctrine of creation, because he and this is what Jonathan seemed to be articulating. The problem with emanation is you get a decadence as you go down, right? And there's a real, I forget the author, forgive me, who's write an excellent book, and how Erigena uses that to criticize the Neoplatonic emanation. Right, because because there's simultaneously the emergence back upward, right? There's the return, and they're not, they should not be thought, they're completely interpenetrating, interleaving, interafforting. This is a long way of saying that I thought, and you know, I'm quite open for you telling me I'm wrong, that what Christianity was trying to do was trying to get, you know, the imminence, which has this more of this sense of how God bubbles up. Let's see what God might do, what might emerge, you know, integrated with this Neoplatonic. No, but there's, right, there's the emanation down, but to completely identify them in a non-logical manner. They are interpenetrate, they're interfording. Is that fair, or am I getting
things really? Yes, I think that's true. And I think,
oh, wow.
I sometimes I get tired of people saying, well, the Eastern Orthodox Church is, the Orthodox Church is about, becoming truly human. And I think, well, I always thought my church was about that too. And one thing I really appreciated about your talk about ontology is that there's this, you know, somehow, and Lewis points this out in, he has this chapter in his book Miracles on the Grand Miracle, that somehow, you know, God must become man and must come all the way down to the bottom in order to bring something up, and he takes the whole rest of the, he takes everything else with him.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, theologically, then people get triggered because of all of their, you know, it's a World War I battlefield. That's what Christianity is in so many places, and all these no man's land. And if you take a step towards one, somebody's going to shoot. And it's like, hey, I'm 56 years old. Shoot away, bucko. You know, it's no big deal. But
I think the Eastern Orthodox notion of theosis is really important.
Yeah, and no, I agree.
I know it sounds blasphemous to a Protestant. It does. I mean, I would, genetically, I'm Protestant practically, right, because of the way I was brought up. So I get that, but I understand also what Jonathan's trying to do with that notion, and it's really interesting about, because of course the notion of theosis, you know, in some ways is independent. It's worked out in a very complex way in Neoplatonism before it's ever taken up by pseudo Dionysus, right? I mean, and you know, and there's, you know, they found out that it was pseudo Dionysus precisely because they were able to show how much he lifted from Proclus. That's how they. Show that it wasn't the Dionysus of St. Paul's time, right? And so, I hate people that do these, either deny the Neoplatonism in people like pseudo-Dionysus, or try to say that it's all just Neoplatonism. What I'm finding interesting, and I'm getting a sense of that what Jonathan's trying to do, he's trying to show how Christianity takes over this Neoplatonism and then does this thing to it, does this transformation. And so the notion of theosis is being sort of fundamentally, and I'm really interested. I want him to talk more about that. I'm reading a lot about this notion, trying to understand it better. But I want to get back to it, right? Because if you sort of agree, because I see theosis as exactly the place where the emanation and the emergence are just like this together, and you seem to be agreeing with that. Yeah. What does that, like, if we are the image Deo, right, if we are the image of God, and we use personhood, I think was what your argument is saying, to get into the correct mode for relating to God, and I'll come back to what I have to say about that in a minute, but, right, if theosis is the most appropriate way of talking about the fulfillment of our image, and it's simultaneously emanation and emergence, what does that say about God? Sorry. You know what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to say, like, we're trying to get this really rich ontology of a person and then map it into the way things, our ontology of other things and even nature as a whole, and then using that as a way of trying to say, you know, what is the deepest way we can couple to this reality, for lack of a better term, that we designate with the term God. That's what I'm asking you.
In terms of the term God?
No. Well, maybe. What I mean is, no, not the term God. Let's put the term God aside, because I want to come back to that. What I mean is, what does that mean about God one and God two? Because theosis, right? Theosis seems to create an image of personhood that seems to completely evaporate the difference between God 1 and 2 and make them deeply interpenetrating in a powerful way.
Yes.
And so that's what I'm saying.
And this is why, so Jonathan, our last talk, he said, I want to talk to you about this God 1, God 2 business because people are asking me about it.
Yeah.
And I am not saying, obviously, in Christianity, there are two gods, but...
No, nobody... If anybody takes that interpretation, they're being foolish.
Right.
Let's just grant that. They're being foolish and they're being unfair to you. You're making a conceptual distinction. You're not making a causal distinction or any other kind of distinction. I get that.
Right.
So, yeah, just keep going.
But I think, you know, I struggle... I mean, I see these two sides of it that... And then people say, well, it's his transcendence and his immanence.
That's not good enough.
Right. And so I haven't been able to sort of put it, you know, I haven't been able to figure it out, but I keep seeing these.
Well, here's one thing I would say. Both God 1 and God 2 are, that's what I was just trying to articulate. Both of them are transcendent and immanent.
Yes.
It's wrong to map God 2 or into immanence or whichever, or no, God 1 into immanence and God 2 into transcendence. I think that's a mistake.
Well, I thought you articulated it better than I did, because when I listened to you talk, I thought, yeah, that sounds a lot better than I was saying it.
Well, okay, well, good. So, because again, so you heard in the discussion I had with JP, right? You know, Whitehead's notion. And I have, there's problems I have with Whitehead's notion but you know, he had this, he was trying to do, I think, something similar with the bipolar, because he was trying to say the bipolar, not in the psychological sense, meaning having two poles, not the bipolar. The bipolar concept of God is not the concept of God by bipolar people. It's a way of talking about, because he wanted to articulate two ideas, which I think are really, really interesting, right? And so give me a sec here, right? There's a sense in which he says, look, and this is, I think, and this is the Plato, and Whitehead is clear about this. This is the Plato and Whitehead. There's a sense in which, and you know that I think possibility is real, because I've argued for that, and I think that science depends on the presupposition that possibility is real. So it's not actual, but it's real, and that's another important distinction. Okay, so there's a sense in which real possibility must really be organized. Because things don't come into being in some slapdash. They always come into a way that has eidos, intelligibility. So there is a forming of possibility. Now, sorry, let me finish the point, right? But there's also the ongoing real emergence, what Whitehead called real novelty. As the universe unfolds, there's constant real emergence. There's real novelty, ontological newness. And he saw God as encompassing both of those things. And both of them are both immanent and transcendent. To say the God of possibility is the transcendent one and the emergent one. That's mistaken. And that's why I've been avoiding the transcendence immanence language. I'm trying to get this other thing with this notion to talk about the direction we're talking rather than the location. You know, there's the emergence of creativity that is just all around us, right? But it's deeply mysterious because, you know, it's one of the, you know, the ultimate problems in physics, right? But then there's the emanation of, you'll allow me this language, of, you know, there's a sense in which things are structured in real possibility, like the eidos of Plato, so that we can make sense of that possibility and why actuality is intelligible to us. Now, I think Whitehead makes a mistake. I think he knuckles under and he says, oh, but the real possibility has to be in something actual, and then he folds it into something like Aristotle's, you know, unmoved mover, and I think, you lost your nerve. Stop thinking that things can only be real if they're actual. I think that's a mistake. But so while I'm critical of it, I guess I'm saying I would like you to read some of this.
I think I want to. I haven't read hardly any Whitehead. I noted Lewis defers to Whitehead fairly often.
Yeah.
Obviously, process theology. Is process theology, open theism, these become very hot topics theologically. I'm not going to comment on those things.
Into hot water. But it just strikes me that however you and you would all obviously appropriate it charitably because you do that with everything. But I just see that as a valuable place. I mean, that book by Griffiths, God Exists, G-O-D, but God, G-A-W-D, doesn't, is a great, yeah, here, I'll go, just hang on. Sorry, I don't mean to be rude to your viewers. Back in one time. So this is a book by David Ray Griffin. You know, God exists, but God, G-A-W-D, does not. And this is, I think, might be valuable to you precisely because, you know, there's something, I think, analogous to what you're doing with your God 1 and God 2. Hmm. But it's also a good, I guess, defense of a Whiteheadian model. And so it would give you, I think, some useful stuff. There's also Nicholas Maxwell's book. I got to meet Nicholas Maxwell. He's got a book called Cutting God in Half and Putting the Two Pieces Back Together Again, which I think is exactly, and part of it is he thinks part of what's going on in the meaning crisis, and I didn't get a chance to talk about it in this series, and I regret that. So I'm talking about it now, right? Is that part of what we're trying to do in the meaning crisis is get these two back, these two halves back together again. So I would recommend those two books as a valuable resource for you to, I think, help, well, give you more vocabulary and even a foil for your thinking.
No, that's really helpful. Because again, for me, I'm stumbling my way through this.
So we all are.
This is intuitive. And you know, I kept watching this conversation fall out, and it's like, there's, and then more people come and ask me questions and I have to think about it some more. And this is where it's gone.
I tried to contribute with my talk of, you know,
that's very helpful.
The deeply interaffording, interleaving emanation and emergence, rather than talking about, you know, things in places, talking about, you know, the directionality in which we're trying to unfold ontological relations. I think that's a more useful way of talking for me, at least.
Well, and you know, there's a very old, long conversation in Christianity about, you know, in some ways, Platonism can be very static.
Yes.
And what, especially when you put the New Testament onto the Old Testament, you get a very active movement towards an end. And this launched in my own tiny little subculture a spat between infralapsarianism and supralapsarianism.
I don't know what that means.
Exactly. but this was a hot debate. And in fact, there were a couple of professors at Calvin College who lost their job poking around in Irenaeus and making some comments about this, because this gets into the question of, so you have creation, fall, redemption, restoration, mm-hmm. consummation. To what extent is this story of Christ necessary for God to achieve that which he wants to achieve in this entire project of the world? And you can very quickly see that lots of things get put in play in a conversation like that. And a lot of people who are looking to protect God's reputation or ideas about God's reputation in certain ways, things get very complicated in a conversation like that. But it gets very much into, I've really enjoyed hearing your, you know, okay, it isn't just emergence, it isn't just eminence, but when you talk about there is a, now obviously in terms of Christian theology, God starts this business. Right. We don't have an eternal universe to the degree that we know it, but to what degree is the telos that God is reaching for from the drama that we find in Christianity, the creation of the world, you know, all of this stuff, to what degree must this lapse, is it necessary for God to achieve something? And that turns theological lights on all over the room. And I don't know that we can answer this. My father, actually, this was a spat when he was in seminary. And so he people arguing at it. And he said, are within a Calvinist framework of decrees and all that particular theology in our little corner, are you telling me that you're having a fight over which logical step God took in his mind before the creation of the world? How on earth could you know that? So, but this all does get tied up into these questions of what is God? It gets very complicated. So I appreciate how much you grabbed onto it. And I'm going to have to listen to everything that you said again to really get my mind around and check out those two books, because this is all part of this question of Christianity and how it relates to what is God, what is he up to, where is he going, what is he doing, why does the world bother to exist at all?
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, here's one way in which I would argue the way I'm talking about it has an advantage, because when you put it in terms of emanation and emergence, you can articulate the tension, I think, much more clearly. Emergence says that the effect is greater than the cause. That's what it is for something to emerge. Emanation says the cause is, and this is an axiomatic principle in Neoplatonism, the cause is always greater than the effect. And so what you're ultimately talking about, again, is your notion of realness and how you fundamentally see the relationship between cause and effect at a deep ontological level. So I think one of the advantages of this terminology, this conceptual vocabulary that I brought to it, is it really articulates the deep connection between ways of talking about God and ways of talking and our sort of fundamental presuppositions about realness and causation and how they're operating. So I think it does some important work of clarification in that way.
Okay, a little bit about reality, and I really loved. I hadn't thought about potential. But as I've been working through this, I mean, I'm trying to think about how on earth can I understand this word reality and that which is real? And finally, sort of what I'm coming up with is reality is that which finally controls, colonizes, wins, endures. And so then you're talking about potential as being real, I think is important in that, because we are, I mean, oh. Stuff is time, static, emergent. I mean, all this stuff gets so hard. But
it should be hard.
Often when I hear people talking about real, there's an implicit materialism. Well, this cell phone stand is real because it's material. And it's like, yeah, but the molder, the machine bender that created this stand was more real than the metal that it bent in a certain sense. So figuring out how this word uses in how this goes in language, and this very much then gets deeply connected with the meaning crisis.
I think so. Well, that's why I've tried to, and you've criticized me on this, not unfairly, but I've tried to limit the notion of truth to propositional knowing, and then I talk about power for procedural knowing. I talk about presence for perspectival, and I talk about attunement for participatory, because I think they all contribute in different ways within different modes to realness. Yeah. And so I try to reserve realness for the comprehensive term that brings all of those together. So when we find that the truth and the power and the presence and the attunement are all, in a manifold, what I sometimes call the morifold, right? Then I think that's our sort of touchstone of realness. I would put one thing on that, something that I've been trying to articulate now, and like I said, I make more clear in the last four episodes, is that moreness, it has a tonos to it. It's that power shines in, but it also mysteriously withdraws. Truth shines in, but it withdraws, right? Right. Present things are simultaneously presenting themselves, but absenting themselves, right? And aletheia, the attunement, is both, right? The coming into the shining and the withdrawal of things. Like, so when I say that I think realness encompasses truth, power, presence, and attunement. You have to understand this in this tonal way, right? Tonal, that there's it's both the shining in as phenomena and also the withdrawing, the perpetual withdrawing into the depths of the moreness of things. This is why I tend to think, well, I try to make an argument later that for me, and I'm not trying to put you in hot water, I think of sacredness more in terms of the inexhaustibleness rather than, you know, a kind of notion of authority or something like that, because the inexhaustibleness is, I see, what ultimately grounds all of these and grounds the tonal relationship between them.
Well, I wouldn't push authority and inexhaustibleness necessarily in contradiction with each other,
because perhaps,
holy,
perhaps.
Holy is inexhaustibleness in
sure
there.
Sure. Maybe we have to talk about that. What I'm thinking of is models of the inexhaustible. I mean, this is a phrase and a notion that runs through the Tao Te Ching, right? You know, the Tao is a well that is never used up, right? And the idea, you know, the term is often used that it's inexhaustible, and it's inexhaustible precisely because it's the right. You know, right, everything depends on being, but being depends on non-being, which is the Tao, right? And all of this. And why that's important, why I'm saying that, is because the notion and this goes to what you said about how God wouldn't show up at the Grand Canyon, because that would actually reduce the glory of things, right? So what's emphasized in this otherwise deeply impersonal way of talking about the sacred, the Tao, is the humility of the Tao. The humility of the Tao, that the Tao is the ultimate regulator of things, because like water, it does not assert itself. It sinks and shapes itself and affords itself. And so this is what I meant by a notion of the inexhaustible that is sort of separate from a notion, at least the notion of authority as how I have seen it articulated in the West. And certainly a notion, to be fair to me, a notion of the authority of God that I grew up with that I found very punishing in many ways. Yeah. So that's why I'm separating it, just to put my cards on the table.
And you know, that point is vitally important as a pastor. You know, my parents, my father, in fact, I think it's the next slide. Nope, not yet. my parents, you know, my parents were both serious, dedicated Christians who live their whole life in search of this, but also just tremendously generous and open. And people sometimes look at me and they wonder why I got the way I did. Well, it's because of my parents. And so I'm this
don't
weird.
Don't stop being the way you are, Paul. I wouldn't be talking to you if you weren't the way you are.
I'm 56 years old. I think the cake is baked. So,
No, there's good evidence for late adulthood development. So that's just not a scientifically legitimate claim.
But I understand what you're saying. But as a pastor, I think now switching over into Christianese language, sure. I think there are few things that Christians and especially church leaders will have to answer for more seriously than the deformation of the church, especially when it comes to love. When you talked about the way love functions in Christianity, a lot of people, you know, contacted me and said, I've never heard a Christian, you know, speak so eloquently and powerfully about the role of love in Christianity. And I felt the same way. I thought, wow, here I am, a Christian minister, and this man is talking about love in Christian terms that is so powerful. I think you should take that as a extremely high compliment from not so just myself, any others who heard
please
it.
Please know that I do, and that's thank you for saying that. And I hope you take this the right way. It's meant to not to be self-aggrandizing. I've heard similar things from Buddhists about what I talk about when I'm talking about the Buddha, and like some of the stuff you noted, a different way of talking about dukkha and suffering. And there's been a lot of Buddhists that, and again, my egoic gratification aside, that's very valuable, because it means that the way I'm presenting stuff to both Christians and to Buddhists is a way that's reaching to these levels that I'm talking about, that's reaching to the perspectival and the participatory. And so getting that kind of feedback is very, very important to me. I really deeply appreciate it. And thank you for saying that. I'm saying it's very important to me. It's an ideal that I hold myself to when I'm trying to do the work that I do.
I think you're doing a tremendous job. So let's just finish out the argument here.
Sure.
I think people naturally repersonalize the universe post-Christian. I see this all the time. My favorite illustration is Verizon Lisa, and who's talking to the universe about getting a smartphone. It's right there in a Verizon commercial. And the demythologizing of the world hasn't made people rational in the ways that celebrity atheists imagined it would. And they sometimes just adopt informal, poorly organized pseudo-religion. And I thought, again, some of the last episodes where you're dealing
with that. Talk about that. I totally agree with this. I think that part of what I've also argued is the notion of rational that's being used on YouTube is such a truncated, desiccated notion of rationality. And it's odd, because both the psychology and some of the good philosophy about rationality, people have mentioned L.A. Paul and, Agnes Collard's whole book on aspiration is all about what she calls proleptic rationality, and how we must, on pain of getting into self-defeating claims, include aspiration and proleptic rationality in our model of rationality. I recommend that. So I think that these two things are both resonating in our culture. I think you're right. We gravitate towards pseudo-religious ideologies, and we can't properly critically respond to them or cultivate wisdom within them, because we have such a truncated, desiccated notion of rational. And I think both sides of the debate that you pointed to earlier, you know, what I would call sort of the fundamentalist and the celebrity atheist, the celebrity fundamentalist and the celebrity atheist, I think they're both contributing to this, and that's what I try to articulate. So I guess I'm saying, in a very long-winded, Vervaekian fashion, I deeply agree with this slide. I think that there's something. I think this is an important articulation of what's going on right now.
Okay, this is the last slide. Religion, and you've never been dismissive of religion. You were right right there from the start. Religion is the practice of approaching God as person. And this actually, this picture here is my father. It's one of the it's one of the last pictures taken of my father.
Oh, that's nice.
He was at a church. He was at a church retreat, and he was so enjoying the worship at that conference. And one of his friends saw him just wrapped in it and took that picture of him because his face was just aglow. My older sister
was in background too.
Yeah, well, my older sister then, who was both a photographer and an artist, then put the background in.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that's a background that she painted and then put the verse in. And so, you know, religion. And of course, you've never gone here, but religion is the practice of approaching God as a person. The theology and the doctrine approach is approaching God with the spirit of geometry mode, and that's very appropriate in terms of. And I think, and you know, when I think the dawn of the scientific age, as you've noted before, often it were was pastors and monks. I mean, these are the people that are searching for God with the spirit of geometry in order to know him and love him more. And so science approaches God in this way too. And Christians ought to, in my opinion, be, you know, as eager and as enthusiastic about science as anyone. And then as a pastor talking, so now with the meaning crisis and the Jordan Peterson stuff and all of these new people, one of the most difficult things for many of the people who are sort of trying to feel their way through this thing, one of the most difficult things that they have to deal with is, well, you're in this room and you're singing songs to like where, and then you close your eyes and you pray and you all this crazy stuff. And I completely understand how just weird and nuts and awkward all of that stuff looks. Yeah. But in many ways, worship is, and liturgy and all of that is approaching God with the spirit of finesse, and that we're reaching towards yeah. him with the only means and the best means that we as human beings have towards the project.
Okay, so this is very rich and very interesting. So I have sort of multiple things to say about that, if that's okay.
Sure.
So first of all, one thing, I have been critical of the move, which I see coming after Aquinas. Maybe Occam is a good representation of separating theology from transformation. So this is where we lost, I think, an important Platonic idea that, which I see Tillich trying to articulate, I have some criticisms of it, with his notion of ultimate concern. But here's what I'm trying to say, that we can only approach it, we only can approach the ultimate within a process of, you know, ongoing self-transcendence and transformation. And that was axiomatic for theology before. Like if you had said, you know, to Philo or to Pseudo-Dionysus, he wasn't Pseudo-Dionysus, but you know, to Dionysus, if you'd say to him, well, you can do theology, but you don't have to undergo any important they would say, what? Like is known by like. How can you possibly conform to God without becoming more God-like? What does that mean? I don't understand you. That is nonsensical. And yet, we have exactly the opposite axiom. And so here's where I'd come back to my point that, you know, you want the two hemispheres deeply interpenetrating. I think the spirit of geometry and the spirit of finesse have to be talking together when we want to try and talk about ultimate things. Because that we have to sort of exact ourselves ultimately when we are trying to come into any kind of cognitive conformity or even more so maybe existential conformity to ultimate reality. So that's the first thing I would say about that. Now, so I think that maybe supports your argument in some important ways. Now, this is more critical, this point. And I can understand, given what I've said about narrative and given what I've said about other things, how in many ways and I don't want to say the concept because it's inadequate, because we've been arguing that person is not just a concept, it's a modal way of being.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so maybe there's a distinction there you can make to respond to what I'm going to say. I can understand how person is a mode that is indispensable, but I'm wondering if that goes the extra step, which I don't think it's at least not argumentatively warranted towards saying it's metaphysically necessary. Here's what I mean. I see, well, I'll use an example that I'm deeply familiar with, and in which I'm also doing really odd things that people wouldn't, like I'm doing the Tai Chi form. That's as creepy and strange and weird as people closing their eyes and all that crap. Okay, so I didn't mean to say all that crap. I didn't mean it pejoratively. I'm sorry, you know that, right?
Okay. I know that.
So thank you. So Taoism. Now, if Taoism is anything, it is this spirit of finesse through and through and through, and not just in your head. You are literally trying to become more finesse. This is deeply embodied, deeply participatory, right? And you are trying to come into this relationship. And the mode, I think, is, maybe this is what you ultimately want to say. It's not a person, but maybe it's a personal mode. I don't know. The mode in which, you know, if I were to put it this way, allow me to stretch language. I'm experiencing the Tao, right? When in this flow state, when I'm doing Tai Chi, and like through deep finesse, but there's also a lot of geometry involved in doing the form too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That mode to me feels, it feels like neither the term, and I think this is, I mean, Taoism is definitely represents the Tao as impersonal, and that experience doesn't strike me as personal. But it doesn't strike me as impersonal if by impersonal you mean the way I relate to localized inert objects in space, because that's not how I'm relating to the Tao when I'm doing it, right? So I guess I'm trying to provoke you into how committed to two things. How committed are you? I know you are in a Christian. I'm talking about within this argument. Okay, I'm not challenging your faith. I don't want to do that. Blah. Okay, put that aside. Right, but within this argument, how committed are you to person, and does that mean, right? Does that mean that you're talking about something? I don't know. Is that something that would be an appropriate? What am I trying to say? If there were never any people or sentient beings, would it still be correct to say that God is a person? That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I will differentiate here and say, yes, for the sake of this argument, for the sake of this argument, you'll notice that I put God in scare quotes in.
Totally.
And for the sake of the argument, my main argument is that the from what I know about people and persons, it is extremely appropriate, and it's extremely appropriate, it's fruitful, and I don't want to use the word natural, but I can't think of a better way to approach.
It's easy to internalize as second nature. How about that?
That's right. Now, that I'm drawing short here of a metaphysical claim.
Right.
Whereas I see part of my, this is going to probably get me in trouble too.
I'm sorry.
So I very much appreciate a number of times that you've made comments about, we have to be honest, you know. And so as a Christian minister, you can look at some Christians and think, you know, I wonder if they'd be better off if they weren't Christian. And then you look at and you meet atheists, non-theists, and you can have all church terminology, unbelievers, people far from God and stuff, for whom you certainly see life and Now, for me, now we'll get into a little bit of the weeds of my own particular tradition. Part of the reason I remain a Calvinist, even, and at some point we might want to talk about your treatment of Luther, which I thought you're talking a little bit more about Calvin than Luther, but we could get into that someday.
Okay.
But part of what my Calvinism affords me is a disconnection from the sort of very useful but simplistic reading of others by their propositional truth statements.
Right.
And that in Calvinism, you know, deeply important questions of modes of participation in the age to come are all in God's hands and not ours. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly some terrifying things about that, but there are also some splendid advantages to it. Mm-hmm. In that it gives us a certain freedom of relating to one another where, I, after some of my initial videos and I did some initial conversations with some non-Christian people, I got some letters from people that were saying, you fail to present the gospel to them. In other words, there was a certain script I was supposed to read and use whatever manipulation I could so that at the end of it, they would say, you know, now repeat another script. I've always thought that, well, people don't work this way, and surely God, you know, any kind of...
I would suspect deeply anybody who converted in that way under those circumstances.
That's right. Even though I've seen people who have done so and lived remarkably fruitful lives. It might not be connected with the circuit, you know, anyway, so this gets complicated. So the mode of this argument is that it is in fact, and this is why I say I'm not trying to make a huge argument here. It is an argument for the reality of God, and I could put scare quotes about that God. And when I watch what Jordan is doing and why he's getting the response he's getting from all kinds of men wanting to go to church after listening to Jordan. Because in some ways, you listen to what Jordan is saying, you say, huh. Then you watch this response and you say, huh.
Yeah.
And then your meaning crisis stuff sort of framed it all for him as like, oh, well, that's helpful.
Yeah, I think a big part of Jordan's success is exactly that he, and again, it's not totally what he said. It's also the role he assumed. I think many people felt that as a response to the meaning crisis.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I've become very critical of Jordan more recently. For me, when he went to Liberty, that struck me as very, very problematic. Maybe we could talk about that sometime. So that if you're getting, or I'm just announcing that, because if you're getting any hesitance in my face when you're talking about Jordan, that's what's going on there.
That blew my mind when he went to Liberty on both ends of the equation. I'm like, well, that's interesting.
that's a good word for it. And you're perhaps kinder. And I'm not criticizing Jordan as a total person. Jordan, we have a lot of overlapping things, and Jordan has been supportive of my work. I find it, I'm not capable of your charity, perhaps. I cannot find a charitable interpretation of a Jungian going to the bastion of literalism and fundamentalism. Whatever else Jung was, he was a consistent and deep and profound critic of literalism and fundamentalism, and he attributed a lot of suffering and pathology to literalism and fundamentalism. And that's how I don't understand how those pieces go together in Jordan's mind. That's what I'm saying.
I don't know the depths to which he understands Liberty University. But anyway, let's set all of that over to the side, because I could talk about we can talk about that, but I'm not going to go there. But
sorry, I didn't mean to put you. I just brought it up because I noticed my face and I was like this when you're talking about someone. And wanted people to be clear that I'm not responding to you. I'm responding to this that's going on inside my head. Just to be clear, okay?
Well, my point is that, you know, for many people who are trying to work on these things, they wind up in a Christian church and they're like, well, isn't it weird to be worshiping? But also the point that, so I've listened to a number of debates about, you know, intelligent design versus evolution and theism and non-theism. And I listen to people so often, I hear, really, they're really debating something to the degree like, is the end open or closed? Is there intentionality built into these systems?
Or I would say, is the effect more than the cause, or the cause more than the effect? Right? I think that's also part of what they're debating. I agree. I think one of the things that's attracted to me about your thinking is I see you similarly. At least in a convergent manner, trying to get at what I call this grammar, this cognitive cultural grammar that's underneath a lot of this dialogue and debate and diatribe sometimes too, right? And so, I think that's right. I think very often the superstructure is just doing proxy duty for these underlying things, that it might be better if we were more honest and more vulnerable. And this is why I like things like the authentic relating practices and the circling, the stuff I did with Guy, right? If we were more honest at getting down to that deeper level, and then once we're at that level, honestly, then from that position of intelligible, perhaps even intelligible vulnerability, talking to each other from there. I think I see you doing that, and I think that's a really fundamentally good thing.
Well, and then when it comes to, okay, so metaphysics, I say, well, I sort of suspect, and now I'm a formed person just like anyone else, I sort of suspect that there is, in fact, a mind, a sure, God behind this universe, bringing this all forward into, via Christianity, a la Alvin, someone like Alvin Plantinga, the best possible conclusion that we might imagine for a project that God has in mind. Mm. And that's a very happy thought. And yeah, maybe I'm bullshitting myself. But if I'm going to bullshit myself about something, that's not a bad thing to bullshit myself about, especially if it makes, see, and then this is where it kind of gets in. Alvin Plantinga is also from my same tradition. Calvin College.
Oh, he is? I didn't know that. I mean, I've read Plantinga, I didn't know that.
His younger brother was a professor and mentor of mine at Calvin Seminary, Neil. And it's a remarkable family, the Plantinga family. But you know, the beauty that I see is it, you know, affords me not only an optimism about, not only affords me meaning, it affords me an optimism about the story of the world, hopefully not in a Pollyannish sort of way, not that we take away any responsibility from us in terms of our responsibility in the world, but also makes, you know, encourages me to believe that, well, encourages me to do as my master says, which is love your neighbor as yourself all the way up to and including your enemy.
Sure.
Which, you know, and then figuring out, well, what exactly does that look like in day-to-day interactions? Well, that's, you know, tremendously complicated, but, and so for me, and then you say, well, I'm a little skeptical, or more than a little skeptical about.
I wasn't going to say that just then. I was going to say, I think I've mentioned this before, that one of my grad students and collaborators, Jim Sung Kim, has provided, you know, some good initial evidence that path immersion, and try to hear all the perspectival, participatory, transformative aspiration of that, is really conducive to cultivating wisdom. So that people that are in a path, right, tend to cultivate wisdom better than people that don't. So, here's again where again you might jump off. So, the people immersed in Buddhism and Christianity and Islam sort of do equally better than the atheists, but they all do equally better too,
yeah.
Right? And so that's an important thing. And again, to be honest, that right. And so that's again where I try my way of trying to answer that. And again, I'm not trying to push you into anything. I'm really not. But that's where I make the distinction between, you know, what's psychologically, maybe even culturally indispensable for people, and then what is sort of what is like something like a Kantian transcendental. What is, right? What is, you know, there's levels of indispensability. Then there's also indispensability just from being a human being and a cognitive agent. So I think notions of relevance, you know, I think relevance is transcendentally indispensable to us. But so there's two levels of indispensability, and maybe, so I'm whispering this because I'm not confident in it, but maybe religion has those two levels talk to each other a lot, and that's important. And that, but I would also, as the person I am and the thinker I am, I would still hold all of those, and I'm not dismissing, I would hold them as distinct from any metaphysical necessity claims. And so that's sort of where, and I came to a sort of a similar position with JP, right? Or as I said, you know, in the end, I don't have some of the intuitions you have. What I will acknowledge is that you've got good argumentation that makes around those intuitions that I think I can point to many people, you know, regarded as intellectually respectable, precisely because the way in which those propositions are being held doesn't lead to a lot of, for lack of a better term, stupidity that I find in both the theist and the anti-theist discourses that are around. And so that's why I found the discussions with him and with you, I find them very valuable, and with Jonathan. But I mean, at some point, Jonathan and I need to have another extended, he sent me a long email where he's like, oh, I like this and I did this and I had criticism, and I wrote him back. I want to keep doing that. It would also be great. We got to make this happen, Paul. We got to have all three of us talking at some point, or maybe all four of us, including Savella, you know, in that might be a very valuable thing, both from the take she has, because she's sort of in between my position and your position. I don't think she would object to me saying that. And also, and I mean this in a supportive fashion, I don't want people jumping on me, it would be very good to have a woman's voice more in this conversation, and the voice she brings to this, I think is sensitive and insightful and honest. My gosh, she is such an honest woman, right? And that's so important.
Yes, so, I agree 100%.
Yeah.
I talked to Jonathan about it. He said, I got to catch up with him though. So he was like, I'm 12 and he's like, I got to catch up. So.
Oh, in his email, he said he has caught up, I think.
Oh,
so
he must have been doing some carving.
Yeah, I guess so. And so, yeah, he said he was listening to me just auditory. I got to remember that, especially when I do the next series. So often I forget that some people are just listening, and I'm just pointing to things. I've got to be better about that. I got to remember.
It's tough because I think there is real value though in the visual, and so
yeah, and it's hard to translate everything into the visual, especially when I'm under serious time constraints. It's very hard. Yeah. So I want to give you how you want to wrap things up and what you want to do towards.
Well, at some point too, I mean, I really liked it. You're reading a book by Josiah Royce.
Okay. Yeah, there's a book on Royce. It's called, it's by Dwayne Tunstall. I haven't started yet, but I picked it up because it's so interesting. It's encountering Josiah Royce's ethical religious insight, and it's the idea of personhood as the core ontological category from which you try to build your ontology. That's what Royce was trying to do.
Interesting. I don't know anything about him.
Yeah. So that's the insight. This is from the back cover. The insight became the basis for an idealistic personalism. Idealism I have problems with, but I thought the personalism, wherein the real is the personal and a metaphysics of community is the most appropriate approach to metaphysics for personal beings, especially in as an often impersonal and technological intellectual climate. So that's what this person argues Josiah Royce is trying to do. And I thought, again, that might be relevant to you.
Yeah. So, and at some point too, I'd love to have a conversation with you because I am a practitioner because I've got a lot of thoughts about, okay, how can you take, I understand you're putting together practice. I mean, all of these things, yeah. Finally, the proof is in the pudding. How will real people begin to address the meaning crisis in their lives?
And I do talk about that in the series, and I'm doing a lot of work on that, and not just theoretically. I'm trying to put together communities. I'm trying to participate in them. I'm trying to understand I tried to talk about this in the recent question and answer. Like, what does it really mean to talk about an ecology of practice? What does that go? Some of the videos, so in addition to the After Socrates series that I'm working on right now, I'm going to be releasing, for lack of a better word, instructional videos on, you know, what is it, how it is to practice these things, at least how do I see it and how do others see it. So, I take that point is really important, really central.
Yeah.
Anyways, Paul, I will talk to you as often as you would like. I find these conversations immensely enjoyable, I mean this as a compliment. It's like going to a dojo. I feel that the workout is, I both enjoy it in the process, but I also feel the benefits after having had the discussion.
Well, thank you. I've never been to a dojo, but I feel, I also feel like I've had some working out because you obviously bring other things to this, and that's, you know, I like the part when you were talking to JP about, I mean, in many ways we're all smarter together, and if manage to communicate, and I mean, it's a phenomenal thing that we get anything done at all.
It's philia, Sophia, philia, working together, a brotherhood. Right.
Yes.
Right. That's right. Right. And this is a point that Plato makes. One of the biggest ways we bullshit ourselves is we pretend we're doing philia sophia when we're actually pursuing philia nikea. We're pursuing victory,
yes,
not sophia.
Yes.
So
yes.
We got to bring back both the philia and the sophia.
Yes.
Very much.
Absolutely.
Very much.
Absolutely. So we've been going at this almost 2.5 hours, but
we're going to kill your audience.
No, not my audience. Well, the longer the better. When I put out a short video, I get letters of complaint. What's this 20-minute stuff? I'm going to drive.
Right. Okay.
So thank you so much. I'll just end the recording now. And
thank you, Paul. Thank you very much.